Chapter 11. The Democratic Route. This is what New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said in an Instagram video after the Democratic National Convention in August 2020. I think it's important for us to talk about the deeper issues of this election, because let's keep it real, we need to win in November. November is about, in my opinion, stopping fascism in the United States. That is what Donald Trump represents. Ocasio-Cortez was not being facetious. Her comments elsewhere since she entered and rose to national prominence in 2018 repeat a theme. The Trump administration is fascist and must be defeated by any means necessary. She routinely calls for the abolishment of immigrations and customs enforcement, ICE, defunding police, and ending capitalism. In fact, no other politician as high profile as she has managed to mainstream the Antifa agenda, making it politically palatable and even advantageous to espouse radical extremist views. Ocasio-Cortez is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, the political party that openly participates in events with Antifa and sets up booths in illegal autonomous zones. In August 2019, Ocasio-Cortez and Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley promoted a fringe bail fund for Antifa and other violent suspects arrested at a riot in Boston on their Twitter accounts. For Ocasio-Cortez, it's not just about radical rhetoric. She believes in action through mutual aid. Those she helped fundraise money for included Antifa Black Bloc militants who attacked participants and police at a tongue-in-cheek Boston Straight Pride parade. One way to support the local LGBTQ community impacted by Boston's white supremacist parade? Contribute to the bail fund for the activists who put themselves on the line protecting the Boston community, she tweeted. This wasn't just a one-off. In June 2020, she encouraged her 6.5 million followers on Instagram to donate to groups like Unicorn Riot, an Antifa media collective that mixes propaganda and news content. It should be no surprise that her militant opposition to U.S. border enforcement, like calling migrant detention centers concentration camps, was echoed by Antifa terrorists Willem Van Spronson and Michael Reinhold. But with the protection of the media, she has never had to answer for her incitement against government agencies. Immediately after the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in September 2020, she stated in an Instagram Live video, "Let this moment radicalize you." However, it's not only Ocasio-Cortez who has successfully injected Antifa-style politics into the mainstream. What we are witnessing are Antifa ideologues, supporters, and sympathizers realizing the efficacy of state and social subversion through the legal democratic process. Most hardcore Antifa do not accept working within the legal framework, for example, elections, but they increasingly recognize that this route should be tolerated for success. Violence and riots may achieve certain goals in the short term, such as terrorizing the opposition into silence, but it is the non-violent democratic route that provides mainstream legitimacy. In that regard, Antifa's biggest victories have not been their successes in shutting down events or brawling with fascists, but rather the acceptance and tolerance they've gained in the mainstream left. Indeed, if the riots of 2020 prove anything, it's that a sizable portion of Democratic politicians, intellectuals, academics, and journalists find riots and looting justifiable if committed in the name of racial justice. Before Ocasio-Cortez's congressional election win in June 2018, there was already a high-profile politician working to mainstream Antifa, Keith Ellison. From 2007 to 2019, Ellison served as U.S. representative for Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. He also served as the deputy chairman of the Democratic National Committee, second in command to Tom Perez. As a black convert to Islam, Ellison has long enjoyed the media spotlight for being an American Muslim in Congress. And this has helped overshadow his history of radical views. When Ellison was a student at the University of Minnesota Law School, he wrote extreme essays under a pseudonym in which he defended anti-Semitic Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan and made arguments for a creation of a black ethno-state carved out of the American South. Ellison toned down his rhetoric as he developed a mainstream professional career, but occasionally his mask slipped. In January 2018, the then congressman tweeted out a photo of his endorsement of Mark Bray's Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. In the post, he is seen smiling along with the text. At Moon Palace Books, and I just found the book that strike fear in the heart of @real Donald Trump. His message wasn't just chilling for an endorsement of a book that donates proceeds to an international Antifa fund. His words echo Quran chapter 8, verse 12, a verse often quoted by Islamic State and other jihadist groups to justify terrorism. I will strike fear into the hearts of disbelievers. Ellison proudly kept the tweet up for more than a year and a half. He deleted it after news broke of my beating in June 2019 for unknown reasons. In January 2019, Keith Ellison took office as the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. He was in office throughout the devastating George Floyd riots in his state, and even fueled a conspiracy theory that a cop dressed as Antifa to incite riots. In late May 2020, one of the conspiracy theories spread online was that a black bloc rioter filmed in Minneapolis was actually an undercover St. Paul cop. It was false. This man doesn't look like any civil rights protester I have ever seen. Looks like a provocateur. Can anyone ID him? Ellison tweeted with a link to the video showing the masked man holding an umbrella and breaking windows. In late July 2020, the Minneapolis Police Department said they possibly identified the rioter as someone with white supremacist ties, though curiously he has never been named, arrested, or charged. Since becoming the chief prosecutor in Minnesota, Ellison has been careful in hiding his radicalism. But the outspoken extremism of his son, Jeremiah Ellison, who serves as a member of the Minneapolis City Council, is emblematic of where Antifa sees themselves making the most gains: local governments. I hereby declare officially my support for Antifa, tweeted Jeremiah on May 31st, 2020, in response to Trump announcing his intent to designate Antifa a terrorist organization. The Minneapolis City Council, all occupied by left-wingers, later advanced Antifa's political agenda by voting to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department. Repeating the talking points of BLM Antifa, City Council President Lisa Bender said, "We are here because here in Minneapolis and in cities across the United States, it is clear that our existing system of policing and public safety is not keeping our community safe." A veto-proof majority of the council voted in support of the proposal. In the months since, violent crimes have spiked in the city. Jeremiah Ellison isn't the only family member of a high-level Democratic politician to have ties to Antifa. The son of Virginia Senator and former vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine was arrested at an Antifa riot at the Minnesota State Capitol in March 2017. Linwood Michael Kaine was part of the Black Bloc who set off fireworks and smoke bombs in the Capitol building to shut down a rally in support of Trump. He eventually pleaded guilty to obstructing the legal process. His charges of concealing identity and fleeing were dismissed. Kane was only sentenced to a year of probation. One of the immediate political consequences of George Floyd's death was the rush by left-wing city councils to defund police departments. It didn't just happen in Minneapolis. Seattle City Council also voted to defund its police department. In August 2020, they voted, 7-1, to slash millions from the Seattle Police Department budget. This is after the city lived through the deadly no-police experiment of the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, CHAZ. The only council member who voted against the cuts was Sharma Sawan, the highest-profile member on the council. The 46-year-old Indian immigrant and member of the Socialist Alternative Party didn't oppose defunding police, however. She believed the cuts didn't go far enough. Sawan regularly condemns capitalism and makes excuses for Antifa rioters in her city who destroy businesses, assault cops, and loot. She's not alone in doing so. Fellow council member Tammy Morales told her colleagues in a public meeting in reaction to the outbreaks of riots, "What I don't want to hear is for our constituents to be told to be civil, not to be reactionary, to be told looting doesn't solve anything." Statements like these give fuel, momentum, and legitimacy to Antifa's violence. After CHAZ was dissolved, BLM Antifa rioters continued to organize weekly riots targeting businesses, police stations, the police union hall, and even the home of the union's president, Mike Solan. The militants have also tried to barricade officers inside the East Precinct using quick-drying cement while simultaneously setting fire to the building. Those on city council did not and do not condemn the violence against police. In Portland, a similar political story is playing out. The city's establishment Democratic mayor, Ted Wheeler, came into office in early 2017. Though his history as a politician showed him to be a run-of-the-mill liberal from a wealthy family background, he's moved left since coming into office to try to appease the loud, insatiable far left in Portland. He has adopted their rhetoric, speaking frequently about white supremacy, white privilege, white racism, and fascism. Under his leadership as the police commissioner, a dual role for the mayor in Portland, police have been made feckless. Morale is out the window. Police operate under a directive that they should avoid active policing of demonstrations if their presence is perceived as an agitation. If we identify that we might be the problem, that we might be the agitation there, we will remove ourselves physically from the protest to try to de-escalate, Captain Craig Dobson said at a press conference in August 2019. Newsflash. Antifa and their sympathizers view all law enforcement as an agitation. By pulling back on policing violent protest, Antifa are given the permission to riot every day. And that's exactly what they did through most of 2020. But it's not only Mayor Wheeler who has empowered Antifa. To his political left is Council Member Joanne Hardesty. As the first black woman elected to Portland City Council, Hardesty has used her race as a bludgeon against the mayor and the city's majority white population. She's been championed by Antifa ideologues in Portland, who view her as an ally in city government, given their shared hatred of police. Hardesty routinely criticizes law enforcement and makes excuses for Antifa violence. When BLM-inspired rioting and looting first broke out in late May, Hardesty organized a press conference in place of the mayor, who was out of town, where she announced a conspiracy theory that white supremacists were behind the city's violence. "When we allow white nationalists and white supremacists to infiltrate our peaceful protest and then create the kind of chaos and damage in our community, we must make that stop," Hardesty said. This was completely baseless, as evident by those who have been identified in the arrest records. Then, in July, Hardesty took her conspiracies further. After weeks of daily riots and violent protests, she was quoted in Marie Claire saying that Portland police officers were the ones starting fires to blame peaceful Antifa protesters. "I believe Portland police is lying about the damage, or starting the fires themselves, so that they have justification for attacking community members," she said in the interview. Chuck Lovell, the police chief, publicly asked her for evidence of the shocking claim. She later admitted she had none. Rhetoric like this from elected officials provides morale and legitimacy to Antifa. But sometimes politicians even actively take steps to aid them directly. In response to the city's riots, Mayor Wheeler banned Portland police from cooperating with federal law enforcement during the height of the riots in downtown in July 2020. In September 2020, he issued another directive banning Portland police from using tear gas for crowd control. When the police chief attempted to push back, Wheeler publicly admonished him. In a statement from his office, he said, "The Portland Police Bureau's decision to put out a press release questioning my direction was a serious breach of protocol and an inappropriate use of city communications resources. I made it clear, in no uncertain terms, to the chief that this cannot happen again." Before Portland Antifa emboldened themselves to influence local government, they did a test run at the neighborhood level. In 2017, a group planned and successfully took over a Northeast Portland neighborhood association that has a direct line to city council. Jonathan Ogden, one of the board members at the time, spearheaded this effort. In a leaked document authored by Ogden, he wrote about how to silently take over neighborhood associations with the goal of creating autonomy areas. Using the legal framework already in place in Portland, the neighborhood action councils would take up the task of select members coordinating and sustaining a majority within each neighborhood association, as well as create proposals to have brought to the council that will further goals in line with the overall vision of popular self-determination, Ogden wrote in the March 2017 document. In order to carry out the plan, he wrote that they would need to organize for elections, field candidates, crowdfund money, and coordinate a response network able to swarm votes. The document included a proposed year-long project timeline that concluded with a revolution summer. The plan was ambitious, and in many ways it was modeled on how the Antifa paramilitary controlled certain neighborhoods in the interwar years of Germany. Simply put, the goal was to create light versions of anarchist communist communes within the city. Ogden's plan was a success. In October 2017, Ogden and a group of allied candidates from his Antifa network won elections in the Montevilla Neighborhood Association. Together, they now formed a bloc and political majority on the association. Political moderates in the community and those aligned with the old guard tell me it was indeed a takeover. They're afraid to speak on record, but say there were irregularities in the voting process, suspecting that dozens and dozens of voters who didn't actually live in the neighborhood were brought in. Those elected, or re-elected to the board, included Micah Fletcher and Johnny Shaver, respectively. Fletcher is a Portland activist who fought a mentally unstable man named Jeremy Christian on a moving train in 2017 because he believed he was a white supremacist. The incident resulted in the deaths of two other men when Christian began stabbing the people around him in a fit of rage. Fletcher was seriously injured and survived. Christian was convicted of the killings and sentenced to life in prison, without the possibility of release or parole. Johnny Shaver, the other activist re-elected to the Montevilla Neighbourhood Association, wrote prolifically on Twitter using a pseudonym. She posted explicit support for Antifa causes and against the right. To celebrate their neighbourhood electoral success, the Antifa network held a celebration in a local bar. One of the attendees of that gathering was Antifa street brawler Sean Arminio Kelleher. Kelleher gained infamy in the Portland area for being one of the Rose City Antifa members who regularly brawled on the streets during riots. He also released writings online using a moniker in which he urged for terrorist attacks against cops and bombings on schools. He was killed in mysterious circumstances outside the Cider Riot Antifa pub in October 2019. Witnesses to the hit-and-run incident refused to cooperate with law enforcement per Antifa rules. Online, Antifa accounts urge comrades to delete any communications they had with Kelleher. To date, the homicide remains unsolved.